Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the Salieri Report for the next Salieri Report in the food series. Normally, Harry Blazer is the host. Today, I'm going to host and interview Harry. As you well know, Harry built the largest fresh food market in the country and sold it to Whole Foods, and then has been a consultant and fresh food expert to groceries all around the world. There's no one more competent to talk about the Amazon-Whole Foods deal outside of Amazon or Whole Foods, possibly. They have inside information. So, Harry, it's a pleasure to welcome you. How does it feel to have your former company now sold into Amazon?
Well, it was a portion of the former company, and I guess in one sense it's gratifying and a vindication of sorts. In another sense, well, we'll just have to see how these guys bastardize it.
Well, let's step back. I wanted to step back because you and I have been talking for the last 10 years as we've watched tremendous change happen in the U.S. and global grocery markets. But let's just focus on the U.S. now and take us back to what's happened over the last 10 years, because the change has been remarkable in the last 10 years, and obviously we're going into bigger change. But take us back to sort of the invasion of Costco and Walmart and what's been going on in the U.S. grocery markets.
Well, you know, people can actually get very good information on this by going to Wikipedia and just query Walmart, query Costco, and you see, you get all the history you could want on both of those companies. And it's significant to look at because Walmart's the number one retailer in the world and Costco's the number two retailer in the world.
Right.
So now that's if you don't count Alibaba, which is the number one, you know, in terms of sales, which right. We also can talk about. But, you know, Walmart started back in the 60s. My father was actually the second person in the discount store business before all those guys. That whole industry started in Rhode Island. And as a young kid, I could see the power of what I call disintermediation, getting rid of the middlemen. And my father actually had a very significant case against Johnson's Baby Powder, I believe, back in the 50s, might have been 60s, but I believe it was the 50s, that basically outlawed keystoning, which was the requirement by the manufacturer to sell their goods at basically double the cost. This protected the department store industry. And once that was removed, that basically opened up the discounting store industry, which has been the major retail trend and continues to be, getting rid of the middleman and reducing costs, getting costs out of the distribution system. And so Walmart, Kmart, you know, all those guys and so on basically have had their run here for 50-something years, developed into the wealthiest, Waltons are the wealthiest family combined, you know, that show up on the Fortune 500 list. The guys with the real money don't show up on Fortune 500
right.
They combine, they're the greatest wealth. So that's the run of that industry. It's the most powerful wealth-building industry in the last 50 years. And now the digital guys are taking over, the digital marketplace, and combining with bricks and mortar because they basically want to control all channels.
One thing, Walmart did retailing before it got into food. Food is relatively recent because I remember when I first got here, I don't think they even had groceries.
That's correct. And Costco the same way. Now, Costco is another phenomenon, Sam's Club and so on. But the guy that really started that was Saul Price,
right,
who, by the way, came to my stores with a whole crew of people to look at what we were doing and actually was talking to me about me making bread for him because we had the most unique bread-making capability of any supermarket at the time. And So Saul eventually sold to Costco. That became Costco Price Club, but then just Costco. And that's basically where you paid a membership, and you got prices as like a wholesaler would get.
Right.
Now, you know, you couldn't buy a unit like you could in a supermarket. You'd have to buy in bigger bulk sizes, but it basically opened up another example, you might say, of discounting. And so Costco basically runs their business on a break-even operational basis. So well, I'm going to charge enough so that basically I can cover all the expenses involved in running my business. And then I'm going to charge you a membership fee, which basically accounts for their profit. So one of the key things to look at is that department stores are running 50% gross margins. Discounts, the discounter and supermarket industries, you know, are running 22 to 25. Costco is running 16 to 14. And then 16 if you probably put their membership fee back on, and close to that. And then, you know, Amazon's probably running 10, as is Aldi and Lidl. They might be running 12, 10 to 12 or something like that. So those are the German
retailers. Those are the German discounters who are moving into the United States, right?
Yeah, and Lidl, you know, is one of the largest food retailers in the world. They got 10,000 stores worldwide. And I was in the UK working with Morrisons when these guys came in and totally disrupted the market. Now I'm going around here to answer your question. Because Costco's meteoric growth came after they added food.
Right.
Walmart's Supercenter meteoric growth came after they added food.
Right.
Aldi and Lidl's growth, but Aldi in particular's growth, especially in the UK that I witnessed, happened when they started to carry food. And then when they all started to focus on fresh.
Right.
Also. So you end up now with Costco is the largest retailer of organic foods. They're the largest retailer of a number of other categories, too. And I think even one of them might be fresh food. So food has made a huge difference in terms of the revenues and profitability for the major bricks and mortar retail guys over the last 20-something years.
Right. And that process of them moving in, Walmart and Costco, wiped out, you know, my recollection is an enormous number of grocery chains have been put out of business by this wave of Walmart and Costco moving
We're
in.
We're going to have some links and some additions, as you always do, which are very helpful. And I'm going to include a report from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. These guys have actually done quite a detailed and interesting study on Amazon and the effect of Amazon, which goes to exactly what you're talking about, which is if you think that Walmart, you know, kind of has been credited in many, many places with wiping out the downtown business section, you know, in a lot of towns.
Right.
You know, Amazon has the potential to totally change the retailing infrastructure across the country.
Right.
Now, if you just take a second and take a look at Alibaba, and that's there, you should also go to Wikipedia and look at these guys. Start seeing the list of companies that they own, the acquisitions that they make, how frequent they make it, how many different channels they're into, from, you know, communications to producing movies now to, you know, almost anything that you can think of, these people are starting to get their hands in. And Alibaba is, I think, two or three times the size of Amazon now with online sales. And they have two or three major channels. One is business to business, which is what Alibaba pretty much is. You can only buy in fairly large quantities. But there's this other thing called Taobao, which is dominating Southeast Asia and China and so on, and that whole area. That's basically the equivalent of Amazon. It's business to consumer.
Right.
It's all in Chinese. I haven't been able to find an English version, but they're bigger than Amazon. Just that section of their business is bigger than Amazon. And interestingly enough, I know some guys from Fidelity Investment, you know, which is fairly well known in the United States, and they were one of the first investors in Alibaba years ago. And I imagine, you know, the couple million dollars or whatever it was, how much money that thing was worth, because Alibaba recently had one of the most successful IPOs, I think the largest IPO ever.
Yes.
In the history of U.S. exchanges. It was 20, went in at $22 billion, ended up being $25 billion IPO. And interestingly enough, because you were just in Hong Kong, from what I understand, Hong Kong would not allow them under law to have two classes of stock. And by the way, when I went public, I had two classes of stock. It's very rare now. So they basically decided, because they want to maintain that AB share, you know, that control, to do their launch, IPO launch in the United States. So food is becoming a very, very critical part of the success of now the brick and mortar retailers for the last 20 years, and now the online guys.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, on the Solera Report, we talk a lot about global 2.0 to 3.0 from a industrial economy to the network economy. And of course, Amazon's been one of the leaders of building what I would describe as global 3.0. And what's interesting now with the acquisition of Whole Foods and the warehouses they've been building out across the country, Amazon is moving out of the digital space into bricks and mortar. They're integrating.
Yeah, I wouldn't say they're moving out of it. There's an integration happening. That's the key. There's an integration happening. And one of the way that it's been phrased, and there's been tons of articles written, of course, about this thing, because it is major. They say, you know, is Amazon going to become Walmart before Walmart is able to become Amazon, you know, with their acquisition of Jet and so on?
Right.
So that is the key. What is the integration in the new world of retailing between bricks and mortar and digital going to look like? And it's going to be quite fascinating.
Right. But so before, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay, so before we go too far, I want to talk about what is Amazon, because we've been talking about Amazon as if it were a retailing company. And when Alibaba did its IPO, of course, one of the spins in the marketplace is Alibaba generates a profit and Amazon doesn't. Well, what happened to sort of help bolster Amazon at that time is they got a $600 million a year, I think it's $600 million a year contract from the CIA to provide cloud services, which the CIA is now using to integrate cloud services for all 17 U.S. intelligence agencies. So you know my concept of the data beast. At the same time they did the deal with the CIA for the $600 million contract, they turned around and bought Buffett out of the Washington Post. You know, Amazon is trading at a PE right now of 188 times. It's an unprecedentedly high PE. So you can imagine how much that contract from the government generated in terms of stock market value. So turning around and buying up the Washington Post was, you know, a fairly minor commission on that stock market increase. But so there's a real profound question in my mind as to who is Amazon. Is Amazon Jeff Bezos and his investors? Or is Amazon the U.S. intelligence agencies in the deep state? And what is the integration of data between Amazon and the NSA and the U.S. intelligence community?
So let me just read a little bit from this ILSR, because this will give us a pretty good picture. Behind the packages on the doorstep and behind the inviting interface and seamless service that has consistently put the company at the top of corporate reputation rankings, Amazon has quietly positioned itself at the center of a growing share of our daily activities and transactions, extending its tentacles across our economy and with it our lives. Today, half of all U.S. households are subscribed to the membership program Amazon Prime. And by the way, Walmart has stores within 10 miles of 90% of American shoppers. Whole Foods has stores within 10 miles of 90% of Prime membership owners.
Yeah, I think that's an amazingly important factoid that explains this deal.
So there's the two 90 percenters that are coming head to head. Today, yeah. Half of all U.S. households subscribe to membership program Amazon Prime. Half of all online shopping searches start directly on Amazon, and Amazon captures nearly one in every $2 that Americans spend online. Amazon sells more books, toys, and by next year, apparel and consumer electronics than any retailer online or off, and is investing heavily in the grocery business. As a retailer, its market power now rivals or exceeds that of Walmart and stands only to grow. Within 5 years, one-fifth of the U.S. 3.6 trillion retail market will have shifted online, and Amazon is on track to capture two-thirds of that share. But describing Amazon's reach in the retail sector describes only one of the company's tentacles. Amazon is far more than a big, aggressive retailer. The company is a novel kind of power, a power that, as New Yorker writer George Packer has described, is something new in the history of American business. As a matter of fact, one guy one very well commentator said that it's a $3.6 trillion business hiding or something, you know, hiding under. As we show in this report, Amazon increasingly controls the underlying infrastructure of the economy. Its marketplace for third-party sellers has become the dominant platform for digital commerce. Its Amazon Web Services division provides the cloud computing backbone for much of the country, powering everyone from Netflix to the CIA. Its distribution network includes warehouses and delivery stations in nearly every major U.S. city. And it's rapidly moving into shipping and package delivery for both itself and others. By controlling this critical infrastructure, Amazon both competes with other companies and sets the terms by which these same rivals can reach the market. And it goes on and on. So that gives you a little bit of a flavor, and I think it'd be useful for people to look at this report. But right. But basically, what you've got is, I mean, all companies want to move towards monopoly. Very right. Few companies want to say, no, I'm not interested in doing this because it's against my principles and it's against the best interest of other people. And so, you know, you had Standard Oil and all those guys trying to create monopolies on energy and railroads and so on, that channel, which was quite successful. And the Antitrust Act came, you know, in place to basically bust that up. But nowadays, you've got that power, well, first of all, that intention and also obligation to your shareholders to continue to increase market share, increase value, increase shareholder value, and so on. So you've got a drive towards monopoly almost by law. And then you've got antitrust laws, which have been basically almost decimated. But on top of it, you have a new world of monopoly, of ability to create monopolies in incredible amounts of time, a short time, relative to what Walmart was able to do or even what the railroads right. were able to do and banking was able to do. So basically, technology has supercharged not only the ability to collect data, surveil, understand your habits, react to it almost instantly, but also it supercharges the ability to expand the power over financial markets, over all kinds of markets, basically anywhere they put their sights.
I'm going to be the bad guy here and say, I don't think this is technology. So, for example, when I was in Hong Kong, Jack Ma came down and was part of a group doing a sort of innovation in the Pearl River Delta discussion. And one of the things he was talking about was how important it was to use robotics and AI to help small business be successful and competitive in this environment. And if you look at their growth, their business model is much more helping small business succeed and helping other businesses succeed, as opposed to aggregating and taking them over. And I think it's one of the reasons that my expectation is that they're going to grow faster and bigger than Amazon. Because, in fact, if you look at what's been going on in terms of cost of capital or application of technology, the U.S. government has been making it a lot easier for this stuff to be centralized in a way that's bad for the little guys, as opposed to the way Ma's going about it. So I perceive that the, you know, part of what's helping Amazon is intentional government policy designed to destroy small business and destroy sort of municipal power.
I guess what I would say is this. I think any time a channel has that much dominance, whether it's under the brand name Alibaba or whether it's Amazon or any place, basically they become the dominant ways that you have to participate in a market.
Right, right.
And you know, so I'm not sure that either one is particularly great for small business. I don't think that small business is going to have much of a choice but to use these few, you know, whoever's going to be left standing, these few channels to basically get at market. Because one of the things we need to realize is it is just much more convenient, first of all, to shop online for a lot of things. I mean, where right. I live, I get two-day delivery for anything in the world, basically.
Right.
You know, and I'm out in the boondocks. That's as long as it takes. In New York City, it could be an hour or 2 hours. But the right. second thing is, I mean, I've gone to three different websites to buy a gun-related thing. It's basically just something to practice to secure your weapon when you're doing target shooting. These three sites specialize in this thing, okay? So basically, one of the three sites had it. It was $99. I went on Amazon, plus shipping. I went on Amazon, it was $63, no shipping, because I was a Prime member.
Right.
So basically, after shipping, there's a $50 difference on a $63 item.
Right.
I mean, you can't, in other words, they have totally changed in a fundamental way the economic model.
Right.
And part of it goes back to that whole gross margin thing. You can basically distribute, you know, the other thing I mentioned to you the other day, which is worth mentioning here, is this whole thing called the tail. I saw a number of items that Alibaba has listed on their websites between the various companies. I mean, it was like hundreds of millions of items, hundreds of millions right. of items. You know, a superstore carries 140,000, right. and Costco carries 4,000. You know, Stu Leonard's in New York, which is a famous food store. They brag about the fact that they carry 1,200. I mean, you right. can go and get everything that exists in the world basically delivered to your door in the boondocks in 2 days in New York and almost a day.
So by the tail, what you mean is lots and lots of things in inventory that have very small volume that can carry
right.
the whole
tail. Right. So I happen to know because of some work I did with supply chain companies that, you know, there's whole lines, but a very famous cosmetic companies that are in drugstores that sell maybe one a week or one a month, sometimes less than one a month. But mm-hmm. when you go in, you expect to see it there. Okay, so now you've got this bricks and mortar store that is basically has tremendous amounts of space dedicated to stuff that you sell hardly any of, even grocery stores today. And, you know, they make 80-20 rule is applies in spades. They're getting right. 80% of the business from 20% of their products.
Right.
So now you've got one store and then 4 miles away, you got another one doing the same thing from the same chain. Well, Amazon can serve, you know, an area that would be the equivalent of what 60, 100 supermarket stores would service. And now they can afford to have those items because they're serving that many more households out of one warehouse.
Right.
So in other words, they can deal with that tail, what the industry calls the tail. Of, you know, huge amounts of items that sell very little in a way that the bricks and mortars places can't.
Right.
So that's another huge, huge advantage that totally changes the economic model
right.
for retailing.
So let's turn and just look at what the stock market said about the Amazon purchase of Whole Foods. We know that Whole Foods was what I would call in play. You had an activist investor who'd started to make some noise, and Amazon had been talking to a couple of companies. In fact, or Whole Foods had been talking to a couple of companies, and in fact, Amazon was worried about not getting into a bidding war. So they there was a back and forth, and they pretty quickly said, okay, this is fill or kill. You know, we won't play with a bidding war, but if you look at the stock market response, Amazon stock went up a little bit more than the total consideration for the deal, $13.5 billion. But the competitors got wiped by almost $40 billion. And so we see the the stock market deflating by about $25 billion, which, if anything, reflects the fact that they expect is to see margins get squeezed, and ultimately that means less stock market valuation. Isn't that true?
Well, the market has cast the vote, and they did it almost immediately. And it's that, you know, this joint venture between Amazon and Whole Foods, you know, represents a future that's worth a lot of money, and
right.
Everybody else is a legacy player that who's going to be having to play catch up.
Right.
If they're going to be able to make it at all. But for me, most of the grocery stores are walking dead. You know, I've said that to you before. I mean, these
right.
guys were fairly irrelevant to begin with, and now they're going to become more and more irrelevant. And to a large extent, I don't think they have any capability at all to close the gap, because they keep recycling the same talent. The most innovation that's happened in food has come from the non-food industry.
It's right.
Eataly, arguably. On the on the restaurant retail store hybrid, if people haven't been to one, look it up. When you go to your major cities now in the United States, they started with one in Italy, and now they're almost around the world in a lot of places. So he did a great job on basically making an entire store out of Italian specialties, but combining food service with retail. And then also vertically integrating and owning a lot of the companies whose products he sells, and then Amazon, and Fresh Express, and these other guys that have done online delivery. So it's not the grocers that are creating the excitement, but not only that, the restaurateurs, the food service guys, have been surpassing the supermarkets for now two decades in terms of creating excitement around food and, you know, wonderful things to eat and emphasis on local and sustainability and on. So the supermarkets have become more and more irrelevant.
Well, I just want to take a second and take a look at cost of capital, because if you look at cost of capital, that's where, to me, Amazon just wipes out every other player trying to compete with it. So Amazon, since the bailout, so if we start in November 1st, 2008, the S&P's up 153%, and Amazon's up 1,700%. So this is a stock that's been unbelievably successful for investors, and it's trading at a PE of 188 times with no dividend, which means between its contracts with the government and the way investors are pricing it, its cost of capital is almost zero. It's unbelievable. If you just look at Walmart, it's trading at a PE of 17 times, and it's got to pay a dividend of 2.8%. There's no way you take a look at those two costs of capital and you say it's only a matter of time until Amazon destroys Walmart.
You ask yourself how long would it take even today on a bricks and mortar business like Walmart, who's what approaching $500 billion in sales internationally, but yet who failed in Germany, who failed in Korea, they weren't able to make it in these places. And by the way, eBay went into Southeast Asia somewhere, took over an online auction house, what had major, major market share, and basically within 2 years, Alibaba came and blew them out of the water within two
right.
years.
Right.
So, how quickly could Walmart produce $50 billion in revenue? How quickly could Amazon?
Right.
Amazon could do it in a year. Walmart would would have represented at one point, 5 to 10 years of bricks and mortar growth.
So here's what's interesting. Whole Foods was trading at 30, well, now fully priced with the deal. It's trading at 33 times, so that it reflects a healthy premium. But even that, you fold those earnings into Amazon, and you're going to get a much higher PE on them. But here, it's even better. Whole Foods has a dividend. They can now cancel the dividend and use that money to grow the business.
Yeah. And, you know, to a certain extent, I mean, Whole Foods had hit a wall.
Right.
Their performance had started to decline. Same store sales had started to decline. Profitability was declining. Mackey was in trouble, and that's why these guys, Jana and so on, these other investors came in to force a deal. And who knows, they might have been stalking horses for Amazon, these guys. So, but the bottom line is, this deal also represents the fact that one of the most innovative, progressive, well-respected people in fresh and organic and so on, which is the major trend, had hit a wall.
Right.
And Amazon is bailing them out to a certain extent. Just like Washington Post hit a wall and they came and bailed them out.
For 20 years, you have been at the heart of a war between the consumer who wants fresh, healthy, nutritious food, an entire food industry that's trying to market non-food is food. So whether it's GMOs or labeling, they're trying to market unnutritious crap and get people to think it's food, so they'll pay the prices of food when it's really not food. And, you know, it's kind of like an invisible pricing scam that's been going on. And you've been at the heart of that because you have the knowledge and the intention to hold that line with integrity. And you know what an ugly, bitter, you know, sort of war this war has been. Now,
I have not found anybody in the food business that has more intention in that regard.
Right. Than you.
Right.
Okay.
Not to brag, but I haven't found it.
Right. So Whole Foods was trying to present themselves as having integrity in that way. So I would say that I don't think that they did, but they did better than some. With Amazon coming in, how's that going to change this, you know, this whole effort of marketing non-food as food?
Okay. So this is a very, very critical point. Totally critical. And this would be a very good point, I think, to bring up this critical point that I want to make, and that you've made before, and it hit me very, very right across the head here the other day with this deal.
Right.
You know, you had Hamilton Securities that in a lot of ways was trying to do what I was trying to do in fresh in finance and for local money when it comes to localities and making governments responsible and even in playing field, and increasing transparency and basically going for quality. Okay.
Right.
And you were derailed. You were stopped because it was working.
Right.
Okay. But one of the things you said to me, which is key, it didn't have to be that way. In other words, Hamilton was creating a different kind of a vision for a different kind of a world. So take a minute and talk about that. And then we'll make the comparison with what, I mean, to a certain extent, I was trying to do also.
Right. So what I was saying is new technology offers a tremendous opportunity for the small guy. Technology should make the small guy more efficient vis-a-vis the big guy. So what I was saying is, okay, let's take this technology and use it to do two things. One is to get a positive performance on government money that's negative right now, but let's also use it so that the small guy can compete for capital based on market. Okay? And essentially what the government said is, no, we're going to use government money and we're going to use, you know, sort of dirty tricks to make sure that the big guys can come in and aggregate all the small business. So what they were looking to do was to, you know, aggregate all small business income and flows into the big corporations and combine that with government money to make sure that the Dow significantly outperformed the economy.
Okay.
So what you did was the opposite. You used technology to shut off the market and shut off competition and rig things towards monopoly players. So they played monopoly instead of optimization and markets.
Okay, so now I want to read two more paragraphs from this report, and then we're going to tie a very, very important thought together. And there's still more. Amazon now processes payments for other e-commerce businesses. It makes restaurant deliveries in more than a dozen cities, and it rivals HBO and NBC in producing television and movies. It manufactures thousands of products from blouses to batteries to baby food. It employs more than 1,000 people working on artificial intelligence. It publishes books and it owns titles often dominate the Kindle bestseller list. It's taking on Google in search and challenging Apple in devices. It owns familiar brands like Zappos, Shopbop, and IMDb. Its Twitch has 100 million users, is one of the largest platforms for video gaming, and its Audible is top purveyor of audiobooks. Amazon Handmade is trying to capsize Etsy, and Amazon Business aims to destroy Staples and independent office suppliers. It set up delivery lockers on college campuses around the country and hosts a site that provides lessons plans for teachers. It recently launched a music streaming service similar to Spotify. In the last 3 years, its video streaming has grown from 1% to 4% of all prime time internet usage. It's opening hundreds of brick-and-mortar stores, including bookstores, small convenience stores for groceries, and device showrooms for its Kindle and Echo speakers. It's growing rapidly in Europe, India, and China. Everything you buy, starting with your weekly groceries, will be flowing through one pipe called Amazon, Scott Galloway, a professor of marketing at New York University Stern School of Business, has predicted. So it doesn't have to be that way, but you end up with somebody who,
right,
you know, has a lower cost of capital, has connections with the deep state to a certain extent, is willing to play ball with these guys, use their data and open their data to to intelligence agencies and other folks, you know, whether it's AT&T that we learned about, whether it's Microsoft or you name it. It's like, in order to play this game, Facebook, Google, whoever you are, if you're going to get big and you're going to, have this type of monopoly power, you're going to have to play with ball with us. That's it. That's the entry fee.
Right. And if you look at their Nest products, you're basically talking about putting multiple surveillance gizmos in your home.
Absolutely. It's 5G networks combined with the Internet of Things. You're talking about ongoing continuous surveillance of every activity you do, combined with everything you buy and the channels that you buy through. And now getting, you know, one of the things that Google and these guys never had, they had more information on the customers that were shopping at Kroger than Kroger did. But they didn't have that transactional data. Now,
right,
with Whole Foods, they got the transactional data at the counter combined with all the data they've got with everything else. So the circle's coming. But the point is this. It is moving almost.
I just have to tell this one thing, Harry. Did you see that little video that came around? It was so cute. I retweeted it out. Some young woman just turned to her Nest, or it was Nest or Siri, and said, "Are you sharing these, you know, my data and my conversations with the CIA?" And it wouldn't answer.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it was national security not to answer.
Right.
But anyways, but the point is, it's moving inexorably this way. And a simple question, I guess, you know, you've put the question fundamentally correct.
Wait, before we get to the question, I want to flesh out two more points about what's happening on the ground, okay? Because you're headed towards the most important question, and that's
okay,
where I want to,
yep,
end up, okay? Okay, so I want to talk about sales tax, because one of the reasons that Amazon has grown as quickly as it has vis-a-vis bricks and mortar and small business is bricks and mortar was paying sales tax and supporting the local municipality, and Amazon has been marketing without sales tax. Now, we've seen a pushback on states, and some states are now collecting sales tax, or Amazon's doing some collection. But it's fair to say, if you look at state and local financial impact, there's a tremendous advantage that the online guys have had. Is that not correct?
This report also goes into that and many other ways that Bezos has been smart in terms of using these,
right,
types of openings, you know, to create loopholes. And yeah, sure. I mean, if I right off the bat, depending on where you live. Now, Montana, there's no sales tax. But if you're in Florida, there's 6 or 7. If you're in, what, some places it's 11 or 12% sales tax?
Right. So I live in a state with no income tax and a and
yeah,
a
so right off the bat, I can go to Amazon if I'm paying the same price, I'm saving 5 or 10%. So that was an incentive right off the bat if I was just equally priced anywhere else. Now, like you said, I think there's only 16 states left that have that are not forcing them to charge sales tax.
Right. Although it's interesting, you know, I live in a very small community, and one of the things we love is having our own post office. And one thing I will say is Amazon and the online guys have literally saved our post office from going under.
Yeah, that's until they come up with their own UPS and FedEx network that they're working on.
Right. So there's one other thing I want to say about transportation. I started about 5 years ago to notice that there was a building out of warehouse infrastructure all over the country. If you look at how much money has been poured in every urban area and suburban area into building out huge warehouse facilities where the trucks come in, you know, dump the stuff and whatever. And as the malls, as the sort of traffic in the malls is declining, 5 or 10 miles further out, there's a warehouse getting built. It's quite dramatic. So, and that was clearly in anticipation of what's coming. Because if you look at the traffic those warehouses are getting, it's nothing compared to their capacity. So there is clearly a very well-engineered plan for this switch to accelerate and produce much more dramatic change than we're seeing right now.
So in this report, here's a statement for you. Amazon has pocketed at least $613 million in public subsidies for its fulfillment facilities since 2005, on new research finds. And more than half of the 77 large facilities it built between 2005 and 14 have been subsidized by taxpayers. Okay, Jesus. So, I mean, these are big centers, you know, million square feet or whatever, you
They're
know,
huge.
Whatever it is. And, and people laughed at this guy to begin with and thought he was nuts for building that type of a logistic infrastructure. But it's basically become a amazing competitive advantage. So you got to give the guy some credit because he went against what was the normal thinking of the day, you know, the Harvard Business School studies and how you're supposed to do this stuff.
Oh, I think Bezos is very, very capable. I mean, just immensely. It was funny, I stood up at a conference in 1996 and basically said Amazon was going to take over the world and was going to be, you know, sort of an exceptional investment thing. And I remember everybody looking at me like I was absolutely nuts and arguing with me. I argued it out in front of an audience of a couple hundred people for about 10 minutes. It was kind of interesting. And I said, you know, if I have a database of what everybody in the world wants to know and learn, do you know what I can do with that? Do you know
You've
how
been
I
talking
can
about the power of data, the significance of data for 2 decades.
Right.
And you were the one that said, you know, we're not in control of our government. The government is in control of the government. It's the people that control the data and who they've outsourced it to. By the way, I just saw a story the other day where Eric Prince and those guys are suggesting to Trump that he basically outsource war. Now, a lot of it's been done already, but he's saying just get all the U.S. troops out and just outsource the entire war to my company in Afghanistan. But in any case, here's a couple of things. Amazon's growing market share has so far caused more than 135 million square feet of retail space to disappear, basically. The equivalent of about 700 empty big box stores plus 22,000 shuttered Main Street businesses. Property taxes are the leading source of revenue for state and local governments, and brick and mortar retailers shoulder a large share of this tax responsibility as it displaces these businesses. Amazon, which has no property in 20 states and only a minimal footprint in the places where it does have warehouses, is not replacing this critical source of revenue. Much of the vitality of our cities is linked to commerce that is based on the street and many encounters with neighbors and friends that occur as we run errands. At Amazon, shopping is a solitary activity, and this has profound implications for our communities and how we relate. Local business ownership is a powerful source of social capital, as well as expression of closely held American values like personal agency and community self-determination. In recent surveys, locally owned businesses name Amazon as the top threat to their survival, and on and on. So this is a very good report to use, but it goes exactly to the point that you're saying. The impact for, in other words, these guys have providing a economic proposition which is irresistible. The consequences of that for our lives is not well understood, especially when you combine it with all the data mining, with 5G, with Internet of Things, with artificial intelligence, and all in all. So the point is, what could it be? So now if Bezos turns around and says, if Walmart had turned around and said, we are going to invest in improving the manufacturing infrastructure and making it clean this time, not reproducing Gary, Indiana, where you needed a gas mask to go through the city on the highway, you know, if you're going cross country.
Right.
But we're going to make clean manufacturing, and we're going to basically become the major customer for these guys, so that they never have to worry about having a customer, and we're going to pay them a decent margin. And we're going to sell it at as cheap as we possibly can, so everybody wins. Just think, instead of saying we're going to export all the damn, you know, all of our damn jobs over to China and to have them do the manufacturing and export pollution over there as well and destroy, you know, their life over there because of they can hardly breathe the air in most places and how contaminated things have gotten. So let's say Amazon has the intention.
Well, to get that done, though, you're going to need two things. One, you're going to need the citizens to insist that we enforce the laws related to financial management and government money. And two, you're going to need investors to say, I'm not investing in the stock of dirty
dogs.
Yeah,
and I don't think either of those things are going to happen.
I'm going to shun the dirty guys in the marketplace with my purchases or investments. And the other is, you know, the government has to obey the law. You change those two things and all that sorts out.
It does.
Out.
And it hasn't happened so far. It's going the other way as far as I can see. And I'm just not very optimistic.
Right.
But now just imagine if Bezos.
Well, but I'm not letting everybody out on the excuse, oh, it has to be this way. It doesn't have to be this way. And if you look at what we have to do to change it, it's really that hard.
Now,
I'm not saying that America is not in some kind of mind control trance. I'm not saying they're going to change. I'm not predicting the, you know, immediate success here. But what I'm saying is, don't say we can't do it, and don't say it's hard, because that's not true. Now, are we too lazy? Are we not willing to do it? Are we mind controlled, and it's hopeless? You know, that's a different conversation. But it's relatively easy to change this.
By the same token, I want to bring now to Amazon. Let's say that Bezos intention was, okay, I'm going to make the small farmer the real hero. I'm going to help revitalize soils.
Right.
How am I going to do it? Because I'm going to help, because he gives tremendous amounts of loans. He's got $1 billion of loans out to companies, by the way. I found out also. And it's by invitation only. So basically, he's looking at what's selling on his sites. He goes to those businesses and he says, hey, listen, we'll loan you this money so you'll be able to do this, this, and this, and this with it, and helps him expand it. He charges 14% interest, I think, on the damn money. You know, when banks are giving you 2% for savings. But he's got $1 billion of loans out. That's the other thing that he does for the local businesses on his network. Okay. But let's say that you actually took the right kind of approach.
Now, can I just point out one thing? If you look at what the government's doing, the government has the small banks in a regulatory squeeze. It's making them buy, basically, instead of making character loans to businesses or competing with Amazon, it's making them buy essentially long treasuries to finance the government, and that leaves the market open to Bezos. If the government didn't have the clamps down on the small businesses and, you know, on the small credit unions and the small community banks, you know, it would be a very different story.
So let's say he said, okay, I want the farmer to own his land. I'm going to provide seed. I'm going to provide a community network where people could share intellectual property, ideas, best growing practices, and all this type of thing. We're going to have an insurance policy, crop insurance policy for these guys, so that if somebody gets hurt over here in the Midwest, basically we can spread the risk. And we're going to insist on our brand of fresh, because we're going to build a whole other level of trust when it comes to fresh. That basically we use biodynamic or organic practices of soil, agroecological practices. We're going to, and on and on. He could create the foremost brand in fresh, at the same time creating incredible vitality in local communities and the farming community, revitalize our soil and all this type of thing. The point is that Walmart has that power to do it in many, many ways. Amazon has that power to do it. Now, they're going to choose to do it because they could. And all would do, see, I think that ends up being much better business. They would end up having a middle class that could afford to shop with them. That was Walmart's problem. That's why they hit the wall.
Right.
They exported so many damn middle class jobs that they didn't have a middle class anymore that could afford to shop with them. And how much of the business comes from government subsidies, welfare, or right?
So a lot.
It's a downward spiral unless those people in power who have the ability to do this, make a commitment, or the millions and millions of people that are helping support that network make a decision to say, we're not going to support unless you change your behavior.
You have two choices. You can continue to outlaw entrepreneurship, and play these regulatory and cost of capital games, and at that point you're going to either have massive die-off, or you're going to have what Zuckerberg wants, which is a universal income, or you can simply stop outlawing the entrepreneurial economy. Those are your choices. You can do, you can have a universal income, or you can stop rigging everything from monopoly.
And it comes down to the fundamental question, which you wanted me to avoid.
So no, let's get to the fundamental. Well, the two fundamental questions: are we going to have a human and inhuman world? Number one, and number two, is this hopeless? Do we have to go along with the monopoly model? Because that's going to take us into inhuman.
And all I'm doing is shopping on Amazon and saving money. I want my groceries delivered. Don't tell me I'm making an existential choice.
Well, it's funny.
For the entire universe.
I was always an Amazon fan. And when I moved to the rural areas, at some point, I got to the point where, I really didn't have a choice other than Amazon, other than Walmart. And I was not going to do Walmart. So, but I'm now trying to figure out how to get out of Amazon, because I find their, their sort of invasion of the home. I mean, it's one thing if I'm getting, a book delivered through the post office, and I like supporting my local post office. But it's another thing if they're trying to put some device in my home that allows them to listen to me. Amazon didn't used to be creepy. Now they're getting creepy. From the moment they did the deal with the CIA, they started to get creepy, and now it's like, okay, I really don't want to shop with Amazon. It's way too creepy for me.
It's very, very difficult. What's the alternative? Now, you can go to lots of different sites. I can go to Home Depot, to get that stuff. I can go this site to get that stuff, this site to get that stuff. But, okay, and then sometimes you're going to have to make a decision. I have to pay more, or I'm going to be more inconvenienced to do it.
Right.
So, but I think what we're both saying is that those choices are going to have to be made, because if government's broken, government is a organized crime network, basically, and they're going to be beholden to the guys that pay them, and they don't look at the taxpayer as that. They look at the guys that are basically making those contributions to their election campaigns and on, and that are promising jobs when they get out and so on. So it comes down to the individual again about your choices in terms of who you want to buy from, how you want to vote with your dollars. And I don't know, Catherine. I think we're swimming upstream a little bit here to say, to pay a little more, be inconvenient, and, so that you can have more freedom.
Here's what I think. Let's talk about what the subscriber should do as a result of understanding the Amazon Whole Foods deal. So I think the first thing we all need to understand is this acceleration from Global 2.0 to 3.0 is really happening. Now, certainly in the annual wrap-up, which, I came up to Mentan, and you were a great help in helping me do that. But one of the reasons I wanted to focus everyone on the global harvest and the food business was that I saw this, I said this year the acceleration is going to come fast and furious, and that means that the Global 2.0, the controlled demolitions and the collapse of the pension funds in the state and local government is going to accelerate. Well, that's exactly what has happened. But what I've realized is when the Amazon Whole Foods deal happened, somehow it really made it real to everyone. It's not that Global 3.0 is going to happen. It's that acceleration is really on, and each one of us has to make adjustments. Now, how we do that is totally different. Where my opportunity is in 3.0 is different than yours, but it's real, it's happening, and the acceleration is upon us. So that's number one.
Yeah, and let me just add one thing to that.
Yeah.
I've never seen such a consensus in the business world over a business deal that basically says, yeah, this is great. But not only that, and gives, 7,000 reasons why it's good, but also how it's going to change the world. So, and so exactly to your point, that there is a gigantic consensus that this deal is basically changing retailing and other things in a very, very fundamental way.
Right, right. And I think, the one side of this is Amazon's growing. Another side of this is, Illinois could literally as a state break up, because it's coming apart at the wheels financially. So we could see Illinois, get their bond rating moved to junk, and we could see Illinois or Chicago end up in bankruptcy.
And Apple could buy the debt and own Illinois and only spend one-tenth of the cash that they have.
Right, exactly. one reason, I believe that the reason they pumped and dumped the housing market is that from a very long-term standpoint, it was clear starting in the 1990s that this technology, network technology, telecommunications, digital technology was going to dramatically deflate costs, including energy costs. And I've always said that the money to be made there was not going to be made on the businesses that deflated the costs. It was not going to be made on the energy companies. It was going to be made on the real estate. And so it was clear to me, back then that you're talking about a radical increase in valuation on land and real estate, whether it's peak everything or this, deflation through technology of different costs, including energy costs. And so when you talk with real estate developers, what they'll tell you is you bring a Whole Foods in and you improve real estate values, in the neighborhood. It's pretty significant.
Yeah, so Mark, real estate agents used to advertise the fact that it was near our market. But let me mention one thing, because this is very relevant to what you're saying. Huge amounts of the profit of supermarkets, whether it was Safeway out in California, Loblaw up in Canada that's owned, primarily the major shareholders is the Weston family, HEB, and lots of other places, Wegmans. These guys set it up so they got a separate company that owns the real estate, and they charge the operating company a lease rate.
Right. Right.
They make more money,
right,
oftentimes, for that lease rate, the
right,
rent that they charge their own stores, than they do from operating the stores.
They make money in the real estate business.
Now.
Right. They're in the real estate business, and their profits come from the real estate. I don't know if you've seen this new movie on Ray Kroc and the building McDonald's, but there's one point at which a really smart business guy hooks up with him and explains to him that he's in the real estate business and he needs to reorganize his business model so to reflect, the fact that his success will come from being in the real estate business.
Okay, but now this is the other side of it. Whole Foods, the vast majority of their sites are leased.
Right.
And Amazon is basically a virtual company that's transitioning, but they're basically a virtual company. So huge amount of that wealth is now not around real estate specifically.
But if you see what, if you see the distribution network they're building out, they're going to have a huge impact on the value of the economy in a place. Now, if you look at the guy who's positioning himself to make the money on the real estate, it's Warren Buffett, who Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post from. So you almost wonder, if you look at the deep state, who is deeply entwined with both of them, you wonder if the deep state is planning on making their money in the real estate through Buffett, but creating that value through Amazon.
Right. But by the same token, I sent you, we might want to put this also as an addendum. I sent you an article that was quite interesting. It's called "In the Economic Circle of Life, Businesses Are Dying Faster Than Ever." And what's right. what this is pointing out is that except for a few key areas, they mentioned New York, Miami, Los Angeles, Houston, Dallas, and so on, and Salt Lake City, where entrepreneurs are being successful, the real estate has premiums. There's real vitality, activity. But almost everywhere else, it's the opposite.
Right.
So there's going to be pockets where real estate is very significant, and then other places where nobody wants to own it.
Well, this comes back again to this issue of monopoly. You know, monopoly will require universal income. Now, optimization and markets will permit new growth.
Right, but you're in the process of summarizing in a very important way, and I wanted to add something, but I didn't want to take it off track. So you made your first point.
Yeah.
Okay, but it seemed like you had other points to make, so I want to make sure you make them.
No, that's it, because it keeps coming to this thing. Are we going to have something which is centrally controlled and monopolistic, which is, you know, then requires universal income or die off? Or are we going to go, you know, are we going to let optimization and markets occur, at which point it's going to be much more dynamic? You're going to allow decentralized growth. So think of it this way: you either have decentralized growth or you have universal income. And to me, one is human and the other is going to end up in slavery.
But the confusion is that Amazon looks like decentralized growth, or eBay looks like, or Alibaba, because I'm a business. I now can, for almost no money, I can launch my storefront. They can do fulfillment for me. You know, they can do all this and all this. And, you know, you're basically working for the boss, and you're working at the, you know, you have to buy the stuff at their store, and
right,
you know, they own the house, and on and on.
It's high tech serfdom.
So the point is it's being marketed, and it looks like it's a decentralization process. And you know, Apple and all these guys talk about, yeah, we've given you all these tools for technology so you can the power can now be with you. And that famous 1984 commercial that Apple ran, you know, where they throw the hammer at the screen and destroy.
Right.
But the bottom line is, and I've always maintained, I've been telling people this for years, these mechanisms, and especially the internet, can be the most powerful enslavement mechanism you could ever imagine.
Right. It's what Andrew Vax says. He says the internet is the ultimate op.
Right.
But I come back again to the pot of government money. Because the big lie in here, you know, the big lie is, oh, Amazon's really efficient, and the rest of these guys are, you know, have fallen behind the times, etc. But the reality is, if you dig in and you look at the economics, both by industry and by place, and you look at the impact of the, you know, a combination of dirty tricks plus regulation plus games over the cost of capital, I mean, the small business cost of capital is much higher than, you know, than it should be because of government, government violating government financial laws and basically dirty tricks. So I would say the number one reason that the monopolies have succeeded is violence.
Well, the other way that I would put it is that the guys that are most successful have the best understanding of how to work the system.
Right. I agree.
And as long as there's a system to work, those guys that basically are more clever at figuring out how to work the system than being more clever at how to create, you know, greater good.
Right. And one thing I'll say that the deep state is very good at, it's very good at recognizing talent and if the talent will play ball and using that talent to do things which squeeze out the margins on things and really do bring, you know, very focused productivity in certain ways. So they're very focused on getting productivity on individual processes. Now, they have absolutely no interest in getting productivity on government processes, but when it comes to consumer or private market processes, they're very dedicated to that and they're very good at it. So I'm not saying that there's not a lot of talent here. There is.
Well, Walmart and Amazon, you have a choice. You can really make a difference, very, very positive. For the decentralization team, while you guys make as much money, you know, even more money than you can imagine.
So right, and it's not zero or one. It's not zero or one. You don't have to either buy, you know, the alternative is not to buy nothing at Amazon. I mean, if you live in a rural area like I do, you know, some things, it's the long tail. Some things you're going to have to go to Amazon to get, but there are a lot of other things you can get elsewhere. So, well, but here's the question for you, Harry. Do we have to go along? I just got back, so I was in Bangladesh for a week after Hong Kong, and one of the things that struck me everywhere I went, in private homes, in restaurants, what we bought on the street, the food was so fresh, it was incredible. Even when you were eating a cooked curry, you could taste the freshness of the food. It was remarkable. And it really was a reminder to me how unfresh the food in this country is. You know, it's just a whole different standard of fresh. And
that's what I'm saying. I was on the phone this morning with a major, major retail trying to get them the same message. These guys have the opportunity to change the paradigm. They got the power, they got the market share, they've got all the influence that they need. They can do it. And, you know, it goes back to your three fundamental building blocks: bank local, shut off your TV, and eat fresh. And I would say the biggest choice that we have, and the easiest choice we have, is to support those local conscientious farmers that are truly enriching our lives by taking care of the soil, by growing the right kinds of varieties of food that can give us the nutrition, can give us the joy, can give us the energy to live very fulfilling lives.
Well, I know, and when I come to your house, you've been shopping, you buy a lot from one of the local farmers who we met, in fact, together in 2005. And I'm always amazed. I'll bite into something, you know, particularly the greens, and I just, it's a whole different experience, the nutrition in those greens. It's unbelievable.
Right.
So to me, ultimately, the question for the people on the phone is, now, what's the price you're paying for your food, but is it food? So I think there's, if we're going to have a human future, forget where you buy stuff. If we're going to have a human future, you have to have nutrition. And it's very important to get the best nutrition you possibly can. And I hate to say it, you're not going to get it at Whole Foods, and you're certainly not going to get it at Amazon. I don't believe it.
Well, a friend of mine who had intimate problems with addiction and basically overcame them, said to me, one of the rules in addiction is don't put the stuff in. So don't put the poisons in your body. That would be my recommendation. Don't put the stuff in.
Touche. Okay, before we close, Harry, anything else you want to say in terms of Amazon, Whole Foods, or where the food?
Well, there's many things we can do, many things I could say, but I'll include a bunch of materials. And my analysis, I wrote an article for for a journal and so on. And there's other articles that we can attach, plus a special report. And that will give people the information I think they need to understand the significance of the deal and then also to make some decisions themselves about how they'd like to proceed. But what I want to say is we don't know what the significance of this deal is yet. We won't know what the right. significance is until it plays out. And it can play out in a number of different ways. And there's an opportunity for a lot of good to come from it. And there's an opportunity for a lot more of the same. Centralization, rigging the game, you know, playing the system for the benefit of the few, for the disadvantage of the many.
Right.
You know what team you and I are on, right? We're clear about that.
Well, but here's the thing. I think, you know, you and I are on the pro-decentralization team, but we're on the side of the pro-decentralization team that wants to provide excellence in terms of quality of product and at an affordable price. So I think, you know, traditionally there's been a lot of people on the pro-decentralization team that just wanted to be sluggish. So it's really important if the pro-decentralization team is going to get back in the game and really, you know, we've got to match the productivity on the legitimate productivity on the other side of the fence.
And to a certain extent, that's what those German discounters are showing.
Because and that's going to be very interesting because the Germans are amazing on this stuff.
Yeah, and Lidl, for example, a German company, and already a German company, but Lidl even more so, has actually fairly high standards in terms of ingredients. They were very sensitive to the whole GMO issue all along. And that doesn't mean, you know, they're bringing more and more organics in, lowering the prices, making it more and more accessible. So these guys need to be watched, and they could be a true game changer and as big as this whole Amazon Whole Foods thing.
Right. Well, when I was in Bangladesh, obviously I was meeting with former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, who of course was a congresswoman from Atlanta, grew up in Atlanta, and while you were there, Harry's Farmers Market was where she and her mom shopped for their food. So she said, "What we all need is we need Harry's Farmers Market."
Well, it was great talk with you, and I appreciate the opportunity to visit with your subscribers, and always you. You're just a remarkable person, remarkable resource.
Could you just give out your website and give us 2 seconds on what's coming up on the food series?
BlazerConsulting.net. And, what is coming up on the food series?
Chris Mann. Your interviews with Chris Mann, we're working on it now.
That's right. So here's a guy.
Describe a little bit.
Here's a guy who is who has every book that Rudolf Steiner wrote in both in multiple languages, has been instrumental in promoting the Rudolf Steiner way in all dance and music and agriculture and on and on in this country, whose parents were intimate friends of Rudolf Steiner, you know, which is biodynamics. And this guy is an amazing living resource, and I spent a number of hours with him up in his home in the Midwest, and we've got some very interesting interviews, I think, for people to listen to.
Okay, so the Chris Mann series, he and his wife founded the Michael Fields Institute in East Troy, Wisconsin. One of the great centers of biodynamic farming in this country. Okay, Harry, have a wonderful day. Thank you again for joining us on the Salieri Report.
Okay, buddy. Thanks so much. Thank you.